This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the news all week has centered around last weekend's violent demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, and President Trump's comments in the aftermath. We talk about what our politicians are saying. That event also triggered conversations on the fate of Confederate memorials here. Governor Cooper says they have to go. The verdict is in on the Charlotte School of Law. They shut their doors this week. And we're going to have an eclipse on Monday. The sun is, at any rate. And we have some pretty good seats to observe that once-in-a-lifetime event. We'll talk about that with our roundtable, actually our eclipse version of our roundtable of reporters here. Tom Bullock is not here today, but David Borax is here from our WFAE newsroom. Welcome to you.
Pinch hitting for juror number 9.
That's right. He's on jury duty today. Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
And Doss Helms is here. She is a reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and that is where this is coming from today, from the 10th floor executive suite. Where are we, Ann?
10th floor.
10th floor.
All the way down from the 12th floor.
Okay. Of the Charlotte Observer, thanks for letting us invade your home. And Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal, was brought in here under police escort.
Yes.
from the 9th floor.
It was a lengthy commute.
That's right.
A lot of traffic, but I made it.
Thank you all for being here. You can reach us through CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. We are broadcasting live on Facebook Live today, and you can get to us through Twitter using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, the nation's been focused all week on the clash that grew out of a white supremacist neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville that resulted in the death of an innocent woman on the street and two police officers in a helicopter overhead when it crashed. It brought to the forefront something that has quite obviously been simmering for quite a while, for most of us, in most of our history, in fact, racial hatred. There will be another similar rally in Boston this weekend. The Charlottesville rally was planned in advance because they were talking about taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee in a city park. Why the rally in Boston?
I don't know that I've heard a clear explanation. There was a Vice TV documentary that came out right after the weekend that gave a really good insider view of some of the organizers. And what they were saying is, essentially, we're coming off the internet and into the streets, that these are people who have been organizing and chatting and sharing on some of these neo-Nazi and white nationalist websites. And one of the organizers was quoted as saying, we don't have the camaraderie that the other side does. They've been out in the streets. They've been marching. We're going to do this. So they got their white polo shirts and their khakis and their tiki torches. And I think they felt like this was a very empowering experience to see each other out marching around by torchlight in Charlottesville.
That event and the things that happened in the aftermath have really genuinely shocked a lot of people. Were you shocked, Glenn, or do you see this as part of a continuum?
I wasn't shocked at all. I'm shocked that anyone was shocked. Race has been a part of our national dialogue since the founding of this country. This was just a continuation of what we have seen all along. Of course, we've seen an escalation since the election of Barack Obama. I think that was the wake-up call for our nation, both good and bad. Our nation is changing.
What was the wake-up call? The election of Barack Obama?
Okay. Yes. I think more than anything else, it signified the change that is occurring in America. America's demographics are changing. No one can deny that. And it's becoming much more diverse. It's becoming more brown. There's the projection that by, 2050 or whatever, that we'll be a majority-minority country. No, there will not be a majority race, if you will. And I think the election of Barack Obama signified that. And if you look back in our history as a nation, every time we've made a major leap forward in racial progress, there's been a pushback. And I think that's what you're seeing. I think you're seeing the backlash to that. Unfortunately, I think we're at the very beginning of this pushback. I think we're going to see this for decades to come as we transition as a nation.
Glenn, if you describe Barack Obama's election as a wake-up call, I think the election of Donald Trump was a wake-up call or a trigger of another kind that said to a certain part of our society that it's safe to come out from the dark and talk about this stuff. And, you know, the organizers of the Charlottesville rally have talked about that there are going to be more of these around the country, and Boston is the next one.
Well, I think Glenn's absolutely right, though. That is the the pattern that we've had in this country, which is you have this historic election of Obama, and then you have the backlash that follows, as there is always a segment of people that tries to fight it. Just a tiny piece of this that is interesting to me. I'm originally from Louisiana. I remember when I was in college at LSU, I was working at the student newspaper, and there was a guy named David Duke who almost won the governor's race. And at the time, I remember he would come to LSU football games and get standing ovations. And after he lost, I thought, well, you know, that we'll never hear from this guy again. And it's just a small piece, and you're right, Glenn, it repeats itself over and over. But I still was naive enough to just be flabbergasted that David Duke is on the national scene again, which is just a small part of what we're going to see going on in Boston and beyond.
In the aftermath of the Keith Scott shooting, Charlotte had its own problems with riots in the street, and a photographer by the name of Alvin Jacobs was here in Charlotte. I think he's from Charlotte, who was taking pictures of our riot. He also went to Charlottesville and took to take pictures of that demonstration that turned into the riot, and here's how he described what he saw there.
What we were dealing with in Charlottesville was chaos, complete chaos, people running around with reckless abandon, with semi-automatic weapons, assault rifles, knives, bats, everything you could have just literally running around. And there was nothing that anyone can do about it.
Now, these are people with weapons. We didn't have that really in Charlotte to a great degree. Is that legal? Can you have an assault rifle in Virginia at a march? Is that legal to carry those weapons?
I'm not sure if it's legal or not. I didn't look into the law on that. But you got to ask yourself, you've got a group here that has come out not really for a protest or a march, but for a military-style activity. And what if it was a different group that showed up with shields and bats and guns over their shoulders? What if it were African-Americans? Would the police have done something about that?
Well, we've talked a few times about Charlotte. Police have been under some criticism in the city of Charlotte for their, what was it, the Extraordinary Events Ordinance, which let them say if there is an event, whether it's a huge sporting event or the Democratic National Convention or a protest that we expect could bring violence, that we can really restrict what you can bring, you know, not only guns, but anything that could potentially be used as a weapon. And I believe they backed away from that because there was a feeling that it was being called out kind of every time there might be a problem and that it had become overly onerous.
Were counter-demonstrators in Charlottesville armed? Do we know if they came with weapons?
I don't know if they came with firearms. Right. I think they were. I think some of them were armed, as David said, with bats or clubs or whatever. But getting back to the firearms, I think many states, if not most states, have permit open carry if you are, you know, carrying a firearm in plain view. And I think that's probably, I think that's probably what we saw in Virginia. We've seen it at different groups carrying firearms into Starbucks to protest, or things like that.
And the real truth here is that nobody discharged the weapon. I'm sure that some sticks and clubs were used in the melee, but the real weapon was an automobile.
But if we remember, I think you're right, no one discharged a weapon, but I think it's very dangerous to have weapons in such a volatile situation, as David pointed out. If you remember the Klan rally in North Carolina, I think it was Greensboro, that turned violent. Mm-hmm. You know, when you bring these groups together like that and someone has a weapon, I think we were lucky no one discharged a weapon.
I would still say that there is a difference between you walking down the street with a gun on your hip and a large group of people armed to the teeth getting right together for a gathering like that.
And you think about the aftermath of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting when there were these huge protests in the street, and on the second day, someone did fire a shot and someone was killed. And there was a lot of angst over who did it. There are people who still believe the police did it. There's a young man who is charged and who has said he's going to trial soon.
And he turned down a plea deal.
And has
yesterday
said that he, his lawyer has said that he had a gun that went off. But you think about what if that shot had rung out and somebody had fallen to the ground and a whole bunch of people had been carrying assault rifles,
right. Yeah, I mean,
and
I
had thought the police were attacking them.
Right. It just feels amazing. However you, wherever you come down on guns and where they can be taken, it seems, you know, pretty obvious that when we have protests and we have a volatile situation, it's probably not a good idea for people to be armed.
So much of the conversation about what happened in Charlottesville last weekend is centered around what happened after the demonstrations in Charlottesville, specifically about the president and his response. He was slow to respond to this initially over the weekend. On Monday, he condemned the violence. And when he did, former North Carolina State Senator Malcolm Graham, whose sister died in the Mother Emanuel Church massacre in Charleston, said it was too little, too late.
An apology today is about 2 days too late.
Yes, sir. Yes, yes, yes.
We have to call out racism when we see it.
Yes, yes, yes.
We have to call it out when we hear it.
Yes.
We have to call out when we feel it.
And the fact that this march was started by white supremacists, and particularly those who apparently embrace fascist Nazi beliefs, had some at a Charlotte rally pretty upset.
Love Trump's hate! Love Trump's hate! Love
our grandfathers fought in World War II against the Nazis to preserve our democracy. So what are these guys doing?
I served in the United States Navy for 8 years, and I cannot stand to see someone say they're an American and hold up a Nazi flag.
And then the president rubbed salt in that wound later in the week when he stood in the lobby at Trump Tower and said the trouble was caused by people on both sides and that there were fine people on both sides. This comment seemed to have even people at Fox News a little flummoxed. They didn't know exactly what to say after they came out of that press conference. No American president has ever referred to someone espousing Nazi beliefs as a fine person. What are we to make of this?
It's pretty baffling. I think there are people who would oppose taking a statue down who are not Nazis, who are not white nationalists. But that rally was specifically a white nationalist rally, and it was billed as Unite the Right, which seems to me that if you are somebody who considers yourself a conservative or Republican on the right, and you have Nazis and Ku Klux Klan people saying unite around us, you would be extremely eager to say, no, that's not me.
Well, and it's interesting that there's been so much pushback within Donald Trump's own party. I mean, Lindsey Graham, Richard Burr from the Carolinas, obviously, but you had Orrin Hatch, you've had Cory Gardner. This seems to be a breaking point for a lot of Republicans in Congress and in the Senate in terms of just completely breaking away and saying, no, this is not acceptable.
Really? Do you think so? Here's what Richard Burr said.
I think the president's misguided in his last statements. I think that the commander-in-chief should be very specific about our way forward, not embracing what they did or who did it at all.
He and Lindsey Graham were directly critical of President Trump, but Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, said, "We must be clear, white supremacy is repulsive. This bigotry is counter to all this country stands for. There can be no moral ambiguity." But for him and for Senator Tom Tillis and for Representative Robert Pittenger and many others, they've condemned Nazis, but they haven't condemned the president by name. They haven't distanced themselves from the
That's
president
true.
By name.
I just meant that one small slice we were talking about. I'm not saying they're breaking with the president on all things. I'm saying that it was so over the line that even in the Republican Party, they felt like they had to at least say something publicly.
Well, we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about that. And I know this is the local news roundup, but this affects everybody in the country. And it's an extraordinary moment, I think, in American history. It's the local news roundup. We're coming to you today from the Charlotte Observer with Andos Helms from the Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and David Borax from WFAE News. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Good morning, it's 9:20. More of the local news roundup coming up in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, where support comes from Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing patients with customized care and treatment plans designed to help them regain mobility to live life with a full range of motion. More at novanthealth.org/motion. If you haven't heard, there's going to be a solar eclipse Monday. South Carolina will have a front row seat. North Carolina will have a second row location for this celestial event.
Plenty of people are flooding both locations to experience it, though. Weather could be a concern, so we'll get the latest on conditions, hear about what scientists will be looking for, and check in on the scene of one of the primary viewing locations in upstate South Carolina. Plus, tips on how to safely view the event without permanently damaging your sight. That's all when Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, white nationalist violence in Charlottesville. President Trump blames both sides. CEOs defect. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues next hour with On Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We're coming to you, as I said a moment ago, from the Charlotte Observer with our roundtable of reporters. I mentioned the fact that what made this week extraordinary in many ways is the fact that no American president has ever condoned the behavior of Nazi sympathizers. Glenn, you wanted to talk about that.
Yes, I did. While it's true that no American president has ever condoned the actions of Nazi sympathizers, we've had racism coming out of our White House historically. I think it was Woodrow Wilson who screened Birth of a Nation in the White House, which a movie that gave resurgence to the Klan. You know, we've had Supreme Court justices say that that African Americans or Black Americans had no rights that a white man was bound to honor. I'm actually somewhat surprised by the hyperbolic nature of people's reacting to what Trump said. I didn't find it surprising or shocking at all.
Really? I mean, if it was just Donald Trump, businessman, okay. This is the president of the United States.
Well, I guess
I think what you're saying, though, is that we've seen 2 years of maybe not always the Nazi piece of it, but certainly the racial piece. I think Donald Trump's been very consistent.
Exactly.
He hasn't changed.
Exactly. If you going all the way back to the Central Park joggers who were wrongly convicted, served time, he took out a full-page ad. He refused to apologize after they were exonerated by DNA evidence. He refused to acknowledge. He was the father of the birther movement, or certainly on the front lines of the birther movement. Who can be surprised that he has
look at the housing cases.
Sentiments.
Glenn, you remember the housing cases with the apartments he owned? And, I mean, it's gone on for 40 years. So it really is – I agree with you. It really is puzzling that people are surprised in terms of the president's racial statements and views, because I think that they've been pretty consistent.
So in the post-civil rights era, we have grown accustomed to our presidents and top leaders being circumspect in comments, so they may not come out overtly and say some of the things like Trump does, and we're in
a
different situation.
What's jarring is that you're hearing it from the White House. That's the jarring part, is that you have a president saying what's been said, but in terms of the man who is president, Donald Trump, I think he's been very consistent.
So what you're saying is that this new approach is shaking our worldview. You're saying this is what people voted for. This is what they want. This is what the United States of America wants.
And it's definitely posing a challenge for people who have been engaged in talking about race and racial justice, because there's a new incident every few months, so this is definitely an ongoing discussion. And there has long been a sense that just distancing yourself from the extreme racists and saying, okay, I'm not, you know, I don't use the N-word, I don't put a hood on, so I can scratch racism off my list of problems, but that's a cop-out.
But
and
I'm
now
not
all
sure.
Of a sudden it's sort of a bold statement to say I oppose the Klan and the Nazis.
And I'm not sure it's accurate to say this is what the American people voted for. Because,
it
was in enough precincts around the country that Trump got enough votes. A lot of mainstream Republicans voted for him because he was Republican. But I'm not sure they voted in every case for this kind of stuff.
Well, and let's just sort of push back or, you know, pull back a minute. Remember, he did not win the majority of votes. First of all, that would be the first thing. And then, you know, it's always complicated to figure out why someone votes for a candidate. But certainly with this candidate, that racial piece is part of it. But also there's the piece of let's bring in someone who's from outside and can just kind of blow up the system. And I don't mean that in a violent way. I just mean, you know, someone who's not of the Washington culture. So I don't think we can ascribe all of this to the kinds of things that we're seeing.
Which is why we're asking now for some of those Republicans to step up and put some distance between them and the president.
I would have been much more surprised if he had come out with strong opposition. That would have surprised me more.
Well, yesterday there was this attack in Barcelona in which a driver plowed down pedestrians on a sidewalk with a car. Only one person was plowed down by a car in Charlottesville, but it happened. And the president was very quick to denounce what happened in Barcelona yesterday and to offer his support for the citizens of Barcelona. Very slow in doing that in Charlottesville, Virginia. Meanwhile, our Senator Richard Burr called this a case of domestic terrorism. So if this is terrorism, shouldn't the president be denouncing it as such and prosecuting it as such?
Well, and that's been, I mean, that's why you're hearing people talk about it all week this week. I think there is great frustration that this has not been branded terrorism. To my knowledge, he still has not called this an act of terrorism. I know the Attorney General did, but I don't believe President Trump has called this an act of terrorism yet.
And while the politicians may have been a little slow to respond, remember that the CEOs in the business community started pulling out of his advisory councils so quickly and so dramatically that he essentially did a you can't fire me, I quit move and disbanded them right as they were disbanding themselves.
As an African-American who's lived in this country for 56 years, boy, am I that old?
Only if you say so.
Yeah, really. We've learned to live with double standards. You talked about the double standard of him speaking out against the people or the terrorist in Barcelona and not the terrorist at home. Once again, that doesn't surprise many people in the African American community. We see double standards all the time. When we are the victims or if we are the perpetrators, then it's viewed as one way, and it's not viewed that way when someone else does it.
So as all this hand-wringing goes on the parts of some people, because some people are not upset by this at all. They are very pleased.
Absolutely.
That the president has taken this stance. But for those people who are wringing their hands over this, is this opening our eyes? Is it opening a window to a part of the United States zeitgeist that we've never experienced before that you have?
I don't know. You know, we heard that about the police shootings, and I do think that social media has opened a lot of eyes about what actually is happening on the streets with law enforcement and minority communities. But once again, I think if you're surprised by this, then you haven't been paying attention.
Well, I think, Glenn, also that we have a lot of willful ignorance in this country. As we're talking about these cycles that go on and on, I think a lot of people that look like me, white people looked at Barack Obama. A lot of people wrote and said this, that we were in a post-racial America. Right. We were nowhere near a post-racial America. We have all these deep-seated racial problems. The Civil War, to sort of borrow from William Faulkner, has never ended. And yet we are surprised every time one of these cycles reoccurs.
And speaking of the Civil War, it's a good transfer, I guess, transition, because this demonstration in Charlottesville was over the possible removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee from a public park up there, and there have been some ironic and unintended consequences to what happened after that rally. In response, people in Durham took matters into their own hands. They climbed up on a Confederate monument there, attached a nylon rope to it, and pulled it down. I don't know if you could hear the statue fall onto the ground, but it did fall onto the ground, and then people kicked the statue many times. But because it was on county property, the sheriff is working to identify those responsible and charge them with felonies. Have arrests been made?
I think they've made 8 arrests so far on that.
And last night, about 100 people in Durham, activists lined up to try to turn themselves in to say, I was part of it, I'm guilty, charge me. They actually wouldn't let them in unless they had a warrant against them. Mm-hmm. But that's, yes, there are felony charges against people who were caught on camera, I believe.
Governor Roy Cooper has said there are better ways to remove these memorials, but he also said that the time has come for them to come down.
We can't continue to glorify a war against the United States of America fought in the defense of slavery. Our Civil War history is important, but it belongs in textbooks and museums.
And he called for the legislature to repeal a 2015 law that prevents removal or relocation of monuments. He said that cities, counties, and the state must have the authority and opportunity to make these decisions. Is that likely to happen? Is the General Assembly likely to reverse that law?
In a word, no, not this General Assembly. And I don't think we're going to see them coming down, generally speaking, in the South, where Republicans are in control of state government. Longer term, I think a lot of them will come down because for the same reason that I said, we're changing as a nation. So I think longer term, we are going to start to reevaluate our history. But in the short term, they're there to stay.
There are going to be those who don't want to wait for any process to happen here, and they're going to try and do things. I mean, we had the incident, two of them now in Durham, where one came down and the Robert E. Lee statue at the Duke Chapel was defaced yesterday. Mm-hmm. Somebody spray painted a monument that's in front of a church in Cornelius. We're going to see more of those kind of private acts. Whether there is a long-term public process to take these down, I think it's going to take a while. I don't think they're all going to come down. I think we're going to have a debate about how these got there in the first place and whether it's appropriate to take them down. Well, there is a segment of the population that wants to remind people that this is history of this area and that they think they should be kept.
And that's one of the things that Governor Cooper cited in his statement, saying that they should reverse that law that bans governments from making the decision that you are going to have people taking it into their own hands, and it's potentially going to be dangerous, especially if there is a counter response from the people who like those monuments, that rather than have it being done in a sort of Wild West citizens way, let's open it back up and let local governments decide if they want to keep the Confederate monument in front of their court.
Well, and look at what happened in both New Orleans and Baltimore. I mean, so in Baltimore, you had basically it was done in the dead of night to try and minimize the conflict. And in New Orleans, they had workers who were basically in costumes so that no one would know who was doing the work because they were worried about threats to their safety. So I agree, it's going to be a long, tortuous process, but I think that it is starting to hit a tipping point where some of these are going to start to come down.
Well, because David alluded to the fact that there are people who think this is part of our history, the president among them. He alluded to that in his comments the other day, that this is part of our history, and where do you stop? Do you next move on to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington? There was a letter to the editor in the paper this morning where somebody said, okay, do we go after Monticello and Mount Vernon next? Do we take those places down? But these monuments, most of them, were erected in the beginning of the 20th century at the height of Jim Crow. And were they not a response? Weren't they a resistance, an indication of resistance against the federal government?
They were very much a part of that lost cause, glorifying the cause. That this was a great cause that our white citizens fought for.
But I want to point out, too, a fallacy in trying to equate those who fought against our country with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. No one would argue that George Washington or Thomas Jefferson were perfect. They were slave owners.
Right.
But they did not go to war against America. We don't have statues of Adolf Hitler. We don't have statues of Tojo. We typically don't erect statues and honor people. There's a phrase, putting someone on a pedestal. That, we're putting on a pedestal people, forget the issue of slavery. Forget that. We're putting on a pedestal people who took up arms and went to war against our country.
Which would be defined as treason.
And you don't see that with any other people who we fought. You don't see that in other countries. You don't, countries typically don't put on pedestals people who go to war against.
That sounds very reasoned and very reasonable, but there are people who simply don't agree with you.
And they never will.
And they never will. So how do you explain that?
Well, I think,
how do we get beyond this impasse if that is always going to be the case? And it apparently is.
Well, there are plenty of issues that way. It's popular will. I mean, that's what typically will decide this. Who's put into office? Who's voted into office? That's ultimately how we have resolved these kinds of issues and or the legal system. I think if what we're looking for is for everyone to agree that statues should come down or something else should happen, that's obviously never going to happen. But I would like to add, you know, the other thing is people get really heated about this in a hurry, this issue of the monuments and the Civil War. Context would be very helpful, I think, in all of these conversations if we could get some context in there.
Okay. Aside from the situation in Durham and the situation in Charlottesville, something else happened this week that went viral. A local woman here in Charlotte, Paige Braswell, decided that she could not remain silent about a man in her own town, Mount Holly, flying a Nazi flag. And so she confronted him.
Why do you have a Nazi flag up?
What's it to you?
Because this is America, not Nazi Germany.
Well, don't worry about it. You get your ass in your car and get the hell out of here, best thing I can tell you. What kind of flag do you fly?
I fly a rainbow flag, thank you.
Okay, so what does that tell me about you?
That I'm not a Nazi?
I'm not a Nazi either. This is Nazi America.
Is it?
That's Gaston County resident Joe Love talking to Paige Braswell. And you reported on this, so did you, Glenn. She drove to his house and confronted him?
She did, and I want to claim her back from Charlotte. She is also a Gaston County resident, as am I. We tend to get more attention for the folks who hang out Nazi flags and Confederate flags, but this is, again, part of the changing landscape out there, that, yes, we have diehard traditionalists, and there is no way of knowing what exactly was in his mind when he hung this flag out. What he told the Gaston Gazette was that he had hung out different variations of the Confederate flag and people kept stealing it, so he hung the Nazi flag out to see what would happen. But you also have people like Ms. Braswell who heard about this, and in the wake of all of what happened in Charlottesville, she said, I can't let this stand. I'm going to go call him out. And she did post not only the video of him, you heard some bleeps there, you would hear a lot more bleeps if they played the whole thing, but she also included his name and his street address and his family business, which some people felt like was crossing a line.
He says he's not a Nazi, but then he says this is Nazi bleeping America. How do you explain that?
Don't ask me to explain him or his reasoning.
What she did
takes, that's for him to answer.
What she did takes guts, because absolutely, in today's political environment, you could get yourself killed.
It was.
Yes. But she also told him that she flies a rainbow flag, but she is a straight white married woman with no rainbow flag at her house, I'm told. So why did she say that?
She was making a statement, I think. I thought pretty quickly on her feet. She just responded to his question, and she is a supporter of LGBT rights, mm-hmm, and she evoked from him exactly what you would expect, which was some colorful terms for those people.
She didn't approach him for a confrontation. She approached him to have a conversation.
You know, it wasn't malicious on my end or anything like that. It was just, you know, somebody needs to go talk to this guy. I recognized him from his auto shop. And so that was just kind of like, hey, don't I know you? And I thought, man, this is great. You know, I know this guy. You know, he seems to be a decent guy. Maybe we can have a real conversation about that. But that's just not the way it went down. It's unfortunate.
Everybody says we have to have a conversation about race and racism and hatred. But given what we just heard, is that really possible?
You know, it was a conversation of a sort. Somebody who thinks one thing confronted somebody on the other side. They had a brief conversation. I think they expressed their views to each other. We are all talking about it, so it's become a wider conversation.
Okay.
Yeah, and I do think that the gentleman who was talking, I mean, that's a hopefully very fringe. I don't think that's mainstream opinion.
The local news roundup will continue from the Charlotte Observer when we come back. There are other things to talk about, believe it or not, including the Charlotte School of Law on WFAE.
It's 9:40 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Thanks for joining us this morning for the local news roundup live from the Charlotte Observer. We'll get back to the show in just a moment. Support today comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Encore Series, 5 Broadway shows including The Lion King, Les Miserables, The Book of Mormon, and more. Information and tickets at 704-372-1000. Coming up at 10 o'clock on Point as the news roundup continues, the aftermath of Charlottesville, from the president blaming both sides for last weekend's violence to the renewed debate over Confederate memorials and the defection of CEOs from the president's advisory boards. Also, the saber rattling out of North Korea seems to have cooled in recent days. Those topics and more coming up at 10 o'clock with Tom Ashbrook and On Point. You're on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
All Things Considered on WFAE puts you in touch with people and their stories.
I couldn't square my words with the consequences. It was a moment of clarity for me that the upholding of free speech is not so important that you can protect violence and harassment and terror.
Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, where we are broadcasting today. David Borax from WFAE News and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, found on the 9th floor. We're on the 10th floor.
Better, where am I?
Better view. This week, the end came for the embattled Charlotte School of Law. They faced troubles all year, but this week, Attorney General Josh Stein yanked their license and ordered the school to close. Is this, in fact, the end of the road?
Yes.
They're not coming back.
They were supposed to open on August 28th, and in typical fashion, the owners of the school kept saying, everything's fine, we're going to pull this out. A lot of this was tied to federal loans. I think one of the big questions going forward is, we know who the losers are in this. The federal government put up a lot of money in loans. Right, the students took out the loans and now owe huge repayments. The faculty was planning to come back and have a job. I want to know by name who made the money off of this, because somebody made a lot of money off of a school that did not deliver.
Would it? That's the company that owns that school and two others around the country. Louis Gonzalez is one of the losers. He's one of the students.
These 3 years have cost me in ways that the law school could never even possibly comprehend. And to hear that they've, you know, hung us out to dry is very disconcerting. It's disappointing. It's painful.
The American Bar Association this week rejected the school's teach-out plan, which would have allowed these remaining students to finish out their educations. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they let these small group of young people or students finish out their education there?
Don't know for sure, but I'm assuming it's that they felt like that institution was just no longer viable to provide that education.
And Attorney General Stein says he has written Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos advocating that she expand loan forgiveness protections for those students at the Charlotte School of Law who qualify. I'm not sure how that would, what would make you qualify or not qualify. How many students might that be, and what's the likelihood that that will happen? Anybody know?
I don't know how many students. The number, though, was it was $50 million that worth of federal loans per year, right, before they were suspended. So, I mean, that's fairly easy math. That's affecting a large number of students.
So a lot of these students are leaving this institution without a degree and with a heavy load of debt. What about the transferability of their credits? Because of the academic performance of that school, are those credits viable?
You know, doesn't matter what level you are in a college, it's always difficult to transfer credits because every school thinks they have the highest standards. And so they look at another school's credits and they look down on them. And in this case, you've got a school that has been in trouble for a while and is not, let's just say they're not among the top echelons of U.S. law schools. It's going to be really hard for these students to transfer their credits and go somewhere else. A few have been able to do it. But.
And remember that that's where the trouble started, was that people were graduating from this school and getting their law degree, and most of them were not passing the bar exam. Right. So there was a feeling that they were more than happy to award you a degree there, but not really send you out prepared to be a lawyer.
If you have a degree and it's hanging on your wall and you're in business, you hung up your shingle, and you are from the Charlotte School of Law, what does the going out of business sign on the Charlotte School of Law do to the value of that degree?
Well, I mean, yeah, you answered your own question. I mean, that's the other piece is, even best case scenario for these students, let's say you made it through school and you passed the bar, which was apparently not a common thing with this school. I mean, you have the taint of everything that's happened, the fact that it's out of business.
And that was the other part of it. Not only were they not passing the bar, but they were not being employed in numbers that you would expect.
Their placement rates were
Their placement rates were very low.
One of the groups we heard from this week was alumni who are asking this question, what is my degree worth? I got it legitimately. And, you know, they're trying to get jobs or they are in jobs, and it'll affect their careers.
So Infolaw, which is the parent company of this for-profit law school, owns two others. I think one's in Florida, the other's in Arizona, I believe. What does this closure, mandated closure, do to the other law schools in their circuit, their chain?
I believe the Florida law school has also been under some scrutiny as well, nowhere near what's happened here in Charlotte. But, you know, if you're a student looking to go to law school and you're looking at a list, these are not going to be at the top of your list.
Right. The Citizens Review Board last week, I think it was last week, tied 4-4 about whether or not CMPD's decision was right when they justified the officer's actions in the Keith Lamont Scott shooting. The reason they tied was because they were down a board member. They usually have 9 members, and so they were able to tie here. This week, Mayor Jennifer Roberts appointed, I hope I say this name correctly, Magalies Giraud to the board. Why the timing? Why wasn't that person appointed before this meeting?
Well, I think that's the big question. And they actually, it's even more complicated. It's an 11-member board. So they were down one person and they had 2 absences, which does, again, pose the question of
why have the meeting?
What was the burning thing to do it right then when they were at 8 members? And again, when literally a week later you had an odd number, whether it was 11 or 9, they could have done it and not ended up in a tie.
Is that question being pursued?
It's being pursued by our reporters.
Right. Are we likely to get an answer to that? Or are they going to be as transparent about that as they are about their findings?
Well, and that's an ongoing issue, too, is that the personnel part, I think everybody understands that that is by law confidential. But they also released policy recommendations. Right. And why policy recommendations from a citizen review board that is supposed to instill public confidence in the police department would then be secret is just baffling.
And Chief Putney said this week that he would be open to releasing those, but he hasn't received them yet.
They voted 8-0. They were unanimous in suggesting these policy recommendations to police. As you said, Ann, they've not been made public yet. Mayor Roberts says she believes they should be. The police says he's open. The police chief says he's open to it. Can the mayor make that happen? Does she have the power to make that happen? And if not, who can?
Well, I would think if the mayor and the chief are in agreement, there's certainly there's no law saying that these are confidential.
Why isn't this considered public information? This is a citizens' review board.
I've never heard the answer to that question. I think that's what we've certainly on this show been talking about the past couple of weeks is why wouldn't this just be generally publicly released information other than the personnel piece, which is easily understood. But in terms of process, what was debated, those kinds of things, that seems like, I don't want to say run-of-the-mill, but pretty standard public record.
Eric, it's why we're asking about it. You know,
right.
It's a public proceeding by a publicly appointed body. It is, I think, by law, public. You know, they said they wanted to keep it private. We're not really sure why. I think this will eventually come out.
I think if there were to dig in with resistance, this would go to court. But I don't think we'll have to.
By not releasing it, it really defeats the purpose of having
this. Yes.
Yes, it does.
Kind of. It's taken a while, but you evil meanies in the media have had a victory this week. Media organizations and public records advocates have settled a lawsuit that they filed 2 years ago against then-Governor Pat McCrory. What was this about, Ann, since your newspaper was involved in this?
And I don't remember the exact details of this request, but the Charlotte Observer, the News and Observer, and a number of other organizations would have this experience of filing a public records request for documents that are clearly spelled out as public under the law, and it says that they must be provided in a reasonable amount of time. And we would get stall after stall after stall. It'll be coming next week, and then it wouldn't. And so eventually we had to go to court, which is, again, what I'm talking about, that sometimes you can work things out, and sometimes media organizations have to suck it up and pay the legal bills and go to court to say you have to follow these laws.
Well, actually, you're not going to end up paying the legal bills.
Nice?
No, the state's paying your fees, about $250,000. So will that make the state more prompt going forward in turning over records?
I think Roy Cooper, you know, Pat McCrory's term came to an end, even though he did not expect it to. Roy Cooper is not very motivated to fight for Pat McCrory's delays. So he has said that we are going to develop processes. We're going to make sure that this is done. Again, there's not going to be a magic number of days, but that it does not drag out forever. Mm-hmm. And they were actually trying to charge to just inspect records, which is not legal, and they agreed on that.
Something has been going on, and we've been talking about longer than we talked about you know what. HB2.
Pay up.
The I-77.
Put a dollar in the jar.
That's right. The I-77 toll lane saga continues. And in this latest installment, a consultant hired to analyze the project handed over its findings to the Regional Transportation Board. It will take, I'm told, months before they reach a decision. Do we know what they said in their presentation, Eric?
They did actually disclose publicly what it is they had been doing.
Imagine that.
And essentially what they are doing is offering some potential options that the state could look at to alter this contract, to kill this contract, to maybe alter the number of lanes that are toll lanes. And so this is what's going to be talked about for months. And this is a preliminary report. They want to get public feedback, and they want to get reaction from the Regional Transportation Board, and then they'll come back at the end of September with yet.
It's going to be a while before this is resolved. You know, he wants a final report to be done by September 22nd. Then there will be more feedback. It'll go to the Secretary of Transportation, and then it's anybody's guess when the Department of Transportation will decide to act or not on any of the findings.
Meanwhile, construction continues.
Right. Given the fact that we have a Democratic governor, is that going to change the outcome of this or play a role in the outcome of this as opposed to having Pat McCrory in office?
This process is actually a little bit of a payback by Roy Cooper. You know, during the campaign, McCrory has been was a staunch supporter of the I-77 toll lanes project. Cooper was not in favor of it, and he made a number of statements. It's not really clear whether he ever actually promised that he would shut the project down, but his payback was, we're going to study this and try and figure out if there's a way for us to end this contract. You know, will he actually do that? I think it's going to come down to some economics. You know, we learned from this consultant that at a bare minimum, it'll cost $300 million to cancel this contract. There are other costs involved if they decide to do something short of that, like allowing trucks in the toll lanes. They'll have to do some extra paving. They might allow two-person carpools instead of three is another suggestion. That would cost money. We'd have to compensate the contractor. So there's going to be more studies, I think, in the next few months.
Well, and one big caveat we should mention is that the Secretary of Transportation is very much a pro-toll lane administrator. And so that's been a point of contention and suspicion among the I-77 critics in regard to Governor Cooper. So it's really pretty fuzzy as to what's actually going to happen now.
So we have a mayor's race going on, and two of the three Republican candidates they addressed party members last week, and they disagreed on whether the city has a role in affordable housing. This was between Kenny Smith and Gary Dunn. What is the disagreement?
So Kenny Smith, who's on the city council right now, said in response to a question about what does he think the city should do about affordable housing, he said, I think we have a role to play. He pointed out that the city does have a housing trust fund, and that is funded every 2 years by bond money, which the voters approve. I think there's $18 or $20 million in it. And that goes for new housing units, for incentives for developers, for rehabbing and that sort of thing. And Kenny Smith said, you know, he wants to continue that, and he does see a role for the city. Gary Dunn, the other candidate who was at this forum this week, said he doesn't think there's any role for the city, that if you can't afford to live in Charlotte or near uptown, then, you know, you have to live in the cheap seats somewhere.
Right, and the government shouldn't subsidize you to do so. But he does believe in more money to help small business. So what's the difference?
Good question.
Okay. Meanwhile, the Observer editorial board gave kudos to incumbent Jennifer Roberts for being the best campaigner Charlotte has ever seen. As an example, they said, they highlight the fact that Roberts' campaign manager called on other campaigns to curtail or eliminate the use of campaign yard signs. Why did the Observer see this as a smart move, Ann?
You know, they did not discuss that with me.
I know the answer.
We need Tom Bullock here. He is the expert on campaign signs.
I read the editorial.
He knew the answer.
She doesn't need them. She's running a modern digital campaign, and it improves her image as a green mayor. And if they take down their yard signs, she's a step ahead of them.
I think
pretty smart. Pretty smart.
I think they're right about that, but she's a good campaigner.
Yes.
She's everywhere.
Okay. Monday.
Very aggressive.
We are told by tourist boards everywhere, at least in the line of sight, that the event of a lifetime yes. is coming. And I'm talking about tourist boards from Oregon to Charleston, South Carolina, because it seems we're going to have a total eclipse of the sun. And there is a last-minute scramble by a lot of people to get these ISO-certified glasses so that you can safely view the eclipse. Are there any more remaining in
Charleston? Well, I saw you selling some out of your trunk at Tahrir Square this week. So I don't know if you're sold out.
But they're counterfeit. They don't really work, but I'll sell them to you for $1.50. Are there any more left?
If anyone knows where to find them, please give me a call. I've been trying to find three pairs.
Mike, I will be out behind the building with a pinhole viewer.
That's the safest way to see it.
Like the one I used in 1967.
Now, the Palmetto State is expecting literally hundreds of thousands of people to come in for this. And one way they get in is through I-77 and I-85 and 21, et cetera. It's all these routes that come through Charlotte. Are we, in fact, going to experience this influx of horrible traffic
Have
this
you seen
weekend
these
and Monday?
DOT signs that yes. warn of traffic coming and all that?
That's what I'm asking about.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I'm picturing the attack of the zombies and everybody fleeing, you know?
A million people. I think they're estimating a million people are going to be in South or going to South Carolina to view it.
Now, if you're making plans to experience this eclipse, we want to hear from you at WFAE. You can check our website for details on how to share your stories of an eclipse that perhaps you've already experienced. And this show will dedicate yet another hour to the eclipse on Monday. Everything you ever wanted to know, we'll have it for you to Monday morning at 9. Now, finally, it has been reported that Jennifer Roberts, CMPD, and the Charlotte Fire Department have been blocking and muting tweets from certain individuals, and they include a Shelby Star reporter, Anderson Cooper, NASCAR, the Business Journal's Hillary Burns and John Downey, Franklin Graham, and wait for it, NPR. Why? Is this legal?
The things you can learn with a Freedom of Information request these days.
Did you think Anderson Cooper's working at the Shelby Star?
Why are they blocking or muting these tweets? I don't even know what that means. We have 10 seconds.
It means it doesn't show up in their feed that they see. And why they are doing it? Maybe they can't figure out another way to stop seeing this stuff.
They're blocking us, so expect 2 hours of programming on that. I want to thank David Borax from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from the QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer.